Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some
produced
bad.
In the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The Council on Criminal Justice is a nonprofit think tank that works to advance understanding of the criminal justice policy choices facing the U.S. and to build consensus on solutions. One of the Council's projects is the Women's Justice Commission, a multi-year research, policy, and communications initiative that documents and raises awareness of the unique challenges facing women in the legal system. Women's contact with the criminal legal system has trended upward over the last several decades, and their pathways into the legal system often include domestic violence. The question is how to get the criminal legal system and policymakers to better acknowledge the relevance of domestic violence when addressing women's involvement in the legal system. Indeed, how do these experiences influence trends among women involved in the legal system? And how can domestic violence incidents be better tracked in order to understand their prevalence? The Council recently hosted a fascinating panel to examine these questions entitled Domestic Violence: Understanding the Data and Policy. Let's hear from some of the panelists. First, here's the moderator, Stephanie Kennedy, Policy Director at the Council on Criminal Justice.
First and foremost, I just think it's so important to ground our conversation in data. You can see here that both the raw number of domestic violence incidents, which is the teal, and the domestic violence rate, the purple line, self-reported by female victims and survivors, has fallen pretty dramatically since the 1990s. These data are from the National Crime Victimization Survey. So there were close to 2 million incidents per year in the 1990s. And in 2023, that fell to about 500,000. And while I absolutely want to recognize the great progress that has been made and that really underscore that millions of lives have been saved through the tireless work of folks passionate about this issue, I also will say clearly that 500,000 incidents of domestic violence are 500,000 incidents too many. I also think it's important to pull up and reflect on the important gender differences that we see when we look at violent victimization. Again, these data are drawn from the National Crime Victimization Survey. So women are significantly more likely to be victimized by an intimate partner than men. We're looking at that teal portion on the bottom here. About 25% of women who were victimized in 2022 said the perpetrator was an intimate partner, compared to just 3% of men. The majority of men are victimized by strangers. As we dig a little deeper, you can see here that half of women who are victimized experience that victimization at home. So we're looking again at that teal portion on the bottom, while about half of men are victimized in public places. And you can see that in lavender. And this really underscores the fact that many women have pre-existing relationships with their abusers. Finally, while of course not all victims and survivors are arrested or incarcerated in jails or prisons, more than 75% of incarcerated women report that they've experienced domestic violence at some point prior to their incarceration, most of whom were experiencing domestic violence in the days, weeks, and months leading up to their arrest and incarceration.
That was Stephanie Kennedy, Policy Director at the Council on Criminal Justice, speaking on a webinar held by the Council entitled Domestic Violence: Understanding the Data and Policy. Emily Salisbury, Ph.D., is an Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Utah and Director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center.
Very few women engage in seriously violent acts, and in fact, even fewer women kill. Those who do are oftentimes highly likely to have experienced ongoing serious physical or sexual abuse in their past or in their current lives. So, of course, this doesn't make their violent acts excusable, but it does help us kind of understand how women become violent and physically aggressive. So, of course, the reality is that most crimes committed by women are nonviolent drug and property crimes. And even in these cases, domestic violence and intimate partner abuse can play a role. So one of the many things that we know about girls and women's pathways to offending is that the various forms of trauma and abuse that come with domestic violence and IPV oftentimes create the sort of conditions that increase women's likelihood of becoming involved in the criminal justice system. And this can happen in a number of different ways. First of all, survivors of domestic violence, right, report having very high rates of serious mental illness like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, as well as co-occurring substance use disorder. Childhood physical abuse and sexual abuse is also commonly observed among this population, as is multiple traumatic brain injuries over time. So these needs really kind of compound with how the body physiologically responds and changes to continued threat and complex trauma, which means that things like emotional regulation, self-control, and overall cognitive functioning become far harder to achieve. So, you know, I've got a story here to share. A survivor of domestic violence once told me that women in these relational kinds of situations are oftentimes more violent towards themselves as opposed to externally towards others. And this is consistent with what we know from data, that physical and emotional self-harm, that the kinds of harm that women inflict upon themselves is real and facilitates a cycle of continuing to seek out partners oftentimes that are not good for them and that have significant potential for harm. This, of course, isn't their fault. In many cases, women have been told repeatedly throughout their lives that they are nothing and really aren't worth anything except for what their bodies can provide. This lack of self-worth can fuel women's beliefs that they don't deserve healthy relationships, and many oftentimes don't know what healthy partnerships look like because it's never been modeled for them. I do also think cultural background is crucial to consider in these situations. In some ethnic and religious communities, it is forbidden to question men. So among heterosexual couples in these cultures, the power dynamic is even more pronounced. I think one more thing I'd like to mention, you know, when women give up that their relational power in intimate partnerships because they either don't think they have a voice or are so financially or emotionally dependent on partners who might take advantage of them or become ensnared, right, in physically violent relationships, they're more likely to end up doing very harmful things for or with the partner that you and I couldn't even fathom doing. And so that's oftentimes why we have to build up women's self-worth and self-efficacy far more among women than compared to men. And of course, another way domestic violence has been a driver to women's contact with the criminal justice system is through the proliferation of domestic laws that are dual arrest laws, where incidents, you know, where police can't determine a perpetrator and both parties are arrested. So there's a number of different ways really that domestic violence and IPV can pull women into the system.
That was Dr. Emily Salisbury, Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Utah and Director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center, speaking on a webinar held by the Council on Criminal Justice entitled Domestic Violence, Understanding the Data and Policy. We'll hear more in a moment. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. And now let's hear more. Here's Alex Baquero, PhD, Professor of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Miami and former director of the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics.
So, you know, it's one of the banes of my existence in getting good, accurate data on domestic violence because of exactly the terminology you used. You know, the FBI, when they have their NIBRS reporting system, the National Incident-Based Reporting System, that attempted to expand the way we categorize offending in this country, as well as more details about the incidents and circumstances and victim-offender relationships in those data. But of course, the FBI data is completely voluntary, and it relies on the goodwill of 18,000 some odd law enforcement agencies to report their data. Now, that's one problem. The second problem is that every law enforcement agency has a record management system. And a lot of those agencies did not translate immediately from the old summary reporting system to the new national incident-based reporting system. Some of the large cities that are still making the conversion over to the new system. And then you have the problem of local level variability of how someone might code domestic violence. Do they code it as an aggravated assault with domestic violence flag the way NIBRS does it? Do they just code it as an aggravated assault because they don't understand the circumstances of the case? So you have all of this, you know, what we call statistical noise, because they could be in different categories. So that's just the official arrest or crime incident data. Now what we know from the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is of course a self-report survey of individuals 12 and older, of 200,000 individuals in 100,000 households, it's done every year by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. We know from those data that domestic violence or intimate partner violence is underreported, somewhere between 28 and 60%, depending upon the way you look at underreporting. In our latest research for the council showed that underreporting varies by demographic characteristics. So whatever is being collected at the local level, that's then being translated to the FBI for a national estimate. Whatever number that is, it is certainly a floor, and the ceiling is much, much greater. And that just considers the United States concerns about measuring domestic violence. If you start to do this internationally, then you have even more problems with respect to domestic violence, because a lot of that stuff doesn't even get reported. And even if it does get reported to the police, they don't report it out to the national crime statistics. So unfortunately, for diagnosing the problem and then crafting evidence-informed policies, both on the prevention side and intervention side, we're not really where we should be in 2024 with having a really good understanding of the true nature of domestic violence. And I hate saying that. I don't want to be in a position to say that, but hopefully that there's enough rallying around agencies, not just in local law enforcement, but also at the federal level, about the critical importance of getting better data on this critically important problem.
That was Dr. Alex Picaro, professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Miami and former director of the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics, speaking on a webinar held by the Council on Criminal Justice entitled Domestic Violence, Understanding the Data and Policy. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear once again from Emily Salisbury, associate professor of social work at the University of Utah and director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center.
Yeah, I mean, what Alex says here is just so crucially important in so many different ways. And I think a lot of, you know, feminist scholars in this world would be like, yeah, is that like, when we don't think about women at the forefront of the justice system, you know, our systems were developed oftentimes, right, for violent men. And so in some ways, like, to me, it's almost like, here's another data point, so to speak, right, about not really seeing how the data affect and not having good data infrastructure to understand how many women who could come in, right, with domestic violence in their past. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I take the perspective of, you know, I think most professionals in our criminal justice systems do the best they can with the information that they have. And at a time when it's really challenging, quite frankly, to be in policing, courts, or corrections. And I can tell you that, you know, the movement toward gender responsive correctional strategies for women is, you know, one of those promising things. It's no longer only adopted by like a few institutional and community corrections agencies, which is good news. It has become far more prolific in this area of inquiry. Has also prompted the importance of trauma responsive care, with many agencies really beginning to consider the impacts of trauma on offending, both for women and men and girls and boys. So, you know, the neurobiological impacts of trauma can oftentimes be conflated with not meeting the conditions of supervision, for example. And after decades of pushback, right, gender responsive correctional strategies are finally accepted as being evidence-based practices for women. But like many other evidence-based practices, we run the risk of not being able to sustain them. I'll also say that it's promising to learn that the field of policing is also embracing gender-responsive policing practices for not only their women officers in the profession with the 30 by 30 initiative, but also among women they encounter in the community. The International Association for Women of Police has been at the forefront of this work. I recently actually worked with the Seattle Police Department to develop a gender responsive curriculum for their police recruits before they start their academy, and it's generally being really well received by recruits. But of course, we, you know, have a long way to go. The victim blaming of women for not leaving harmful relationships is still quite prevalent among staff. And I'll just give you an example. I'm currently working with a probation agency in Texas and was on a call with them just last week. And I had a supervising probation officer tell me that one of her POs questioned why he couldn't hold women on his caseload accountable for not leaving an abusive relationship. So basic education and awareness certainly can go a long way with staff.
That was Emily Salisbury, Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Utah and Director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center, speaking on a webinar held by the Council on Criminal Justice entitled Domestic Violence, Understanding the Data and Policy. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now here's Mariam Durrani, Vice President of Policy at the National Domestic Violence Hotline.
There's a million innovations happening all around the country. So I will try to keep my answer short and to the point and just touch on some big points. But innovations are happening at the state level, local level, and federal level, right? And Emily mentioned at the top of her remarks, mandatory arrest. So the re-examination of mandatory arrest policies is a huge area of innovation. You know, those policies had a particular design in mind and they led to a lot of unintended consequences. I say unintended consequences because there was a lot of incredible advocates who sounded the alarm of those coming problems and what dual arrest would look like when survivors and their abusive partners were both arrested. So there's a lot of states around the country that have reformed or completely eliminated these policies. Some people cite to things like primary aggressor laws as a positive movement. So again, there are flaws there, right? It can be incredibly challenging to make that assessment in a domestic violence case when one party has power and control over another. Maybe the survivor doesn't want an abusive partner to get arrested. Maybe there's a language access issue, immigration status, family issues, all of that. But it's one opportunity to add discretion to the case. And I would just say for all the humans attending this webinar that there's a lot of incredible research that shows that mandatory arrest laws have even deterred survivors themselves from interactions with law enforcement. There's some really great research in DC. The National Domestic Violence Hotline, where I work, also did a fantastic report on survivors' interaction with law enforcement. So if you want a place to look for reform or innovative practices, I think that's a great one to start. But another thing that I think gives people a lot of incredible hope is the co-responder model, right? Where law enforcement teams work with domestic violence advocates, social workers, other trauma-informed trained individuals. We're seeing lots of innovative practices in Houston, Loudoun County, Virginia, Los Angeles. And those are just tiny ones. They're happening in every single place around the country, but they tend to be smaller efforts, right? They're often pilots, they're often small cases. And that's where survivors can get the support that they need. It might not implicate an arrest at all, right? So a really innovative way to keep people out of the system. And another innovative model we're seeing is co-response with substance abuse professionals. So what does it look like to get a survivor substance abuse treatment, even while keeping the family together, just keeping the criminal justice system out of the situation entirely? There's also a lot of progress with diversion programs. Any part of the diversion? So I know in California and Washington, for instance, survivors could be referred to community-based services that like try to de-escalate the situation and involve, like offer those trauma-informed services that could keep survivors out of the system entirely. And then restorative justice models, I think, are really, really fascinating new tools. A lot of states are using them, places like New York, Washington State. They provide an alternative traditional prosecution altogether. And I would say on the federal level, the Office on Violence Against Women at the Department of Justice just launched their restorative practices model. So really, really curious to see what happens. One of the problems there is taking a community-based practice and moving it to the legal system. But it seems effective in some cases, and again, it's promising. Holistic legal supports are also becoming more common. I know in DC in particular, there is legal aid that works with domestic violence court specifically that identifies survivors at risks and works on their other legal issues. Just like Emily said at the top, it's not just homicide that's incarcerating people. It's a lot of other components. And then innovative prosecutorial practices, like identifying survivors in the system or in the process that are acting in self-defense, and that preliminary analysis can help, you know, a survivor from becoming a defendant at all. So I think The thing that I would just want to really flag is that there's a growing recognition that the traditional criminal justice responses may often do more harm than good, particularly for survivors of domestic violence. That shift towards trauma-informed, survivor-centered practices, whether it's, policy reform, co-responder models, innovative justice practices like restorative practices, there have to be better ways to prioritize survivor safety and need. And I think we have to take that on as our understanding of what community safety looks like and really center survivors' voices in those solutions. Because a lot of survivors who have been justice involved really have their own solutions for their future and what these systems can look like.
That was Miriam Durrani, Vice President of Policy at the National Domestic Violence Hotline, speaking on a webinar held by the Council on Criminal Justice entitled Domestic Violence, Understanding the Data and Policy. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. While we have time, here again is Alex Baquero, PhD, Professor of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Miami and former Director of the Bureau of Justice Statistics.
Yeah, so we have to run on two different fronts, because you have the official police data and then you have the BJS victimization data. And we'll make a plug to the National Action Plan to End Gender-Based Violence that the White House released about a year ago. And one of the pillars that they recommended was better data infrastructure. And of course, reports are great. Blue ribbon panels are wonderful. But if they're not followed with action, they just another report that sits on a PDF file or someone's bookshelf. So the issue here is it's not that it's difficult to do, is you just got everybody to get them to do it. So within the National Crime Victimization Survey, one of the great things about that data is that it actually details the offense about domestic violence and the circumstances. It also asks if they reported, and it also asks if they sought services. And then if they didn't report, why? Those are really foundational, because if you mine that information, you can find out why victims and survivors chose not to report, and then maybe help that use that information to give them the support they need to then go report. As same thing is true for services. One thing that BJS released when I was the director was where victim services locations are in counties in the United States. There are some counties in the United States that have no victim service providers. I mean, it's unconscionable that exists today in my view of the world. And so we need to get people to feel comfortable and safe in reporting to law enforcement, simultaneously get them whatever services that they are seeking to protect, first of all, to protect their public safety and whatever other avenues that they may need. So that's one part of a data pillar. The other part of a data pillar is standardize. You know, we have standardized definitions of lots of data in the United States. Labor, health, lots of them are standardized. Criminal justice data, some standardization, but you have the issue of 50 different states, and then you have 50, states have different legal codes, and even in counties, there are different statutes of what might explain a particular offense. And then you have when an officer arrives at the scene, right? He or she arrives at the scene, they don't have all of the information. Sometimes the victim is a survivor is there. Sometimes the offender's not there. Sometimes nobody knows what's going on. And the officer is supposed to fill all this stuff out in a field. And oftentimes that data is either missing or unknown. And for anybody working with data, missing and unknown is the worst kind of data I can have, because I can't understand why it's missing and why it's unknown and what to do with it. So at the bare minimum, there needs to be some sort of agreed standardization of what this offense is, what the bare minimum standards are, and then allow law enforcement to populate as much information as they can populate within the incident report. Now, that, of course, is one thing at the local level, but a law enforcement agency needs a record management system to import all that data in, right? And it doesn't cost $10, and you can't download it for free off the internet. So these are millions of dollars in an RMS system, which means you have to also train people. So there's a whole process about that. So one thing RMS vendors could do is basically make some sort of shareware, or at least create some free bare minimum standards, or at least have the federal government or some states like Texas that say, these are the kinds of vendors that RMS systems work and you can adopt them now. Because the more people use very similar instruments, the more standardization we'll have on the numbers that get reported out to the community. So I think it's not a question of, can we do this? It's a question of, do people see it serious enough that we have to do it? In my mind, the answer is absolutely yes, we have to do this, and we should just stop talking about it and let people get to work.
That was Dr. Alex Picaro, professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Miami and former director of the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics, speaking on a webinar held by the Council on Criminal Justice entitled Domestic Violence: Understanding the Data and Policy. Let's hear once again from Emily Salisbury, associate professor of social work at the University of Utah and director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center.
Yeah, I mean, I would just echo, of course, what Alex has been saying. Certainly, I mean, it's just crucial points to be thinking about how we improve data infrastructure, right? I also think, you know, breaking down data silos while maintaining, you know, data privacy would go a long way also to improving outcomes for women. So I'll just give an example. You know, at the Utah Criminal Justice Center, we're working with on a study investigating the various typologies of people who are homeless using data from both housing databases and Medicaid data. And this is a study literally commissioned by our state legislature, and it's still taking like over a year to get the de-identified Medicaid data, right? Like, and there should be protections, of course, and privacy, but you know, we need to be able to access data in different systems more effectively and more easily. And my hope is that we can start to do this more with improved generative AI and strategies that can help us do that safely. You know, it can also help researchers get creative in operationalizing women's success to include variables like successful reunification with children. Healthy babies born to pregnant women could be a positive outcome that we think about. Reductions in substance misuse, of course, and other improved health outcomes. And to the point of one of our participants today, I also think there's a massive research opportunity in bridging data from the criminal and civil legal systems to learn more about how clients are straddling and navigating both systems at the same time, and just how crushing that can be on people. The civil legal system has far fewer protections for people and essentially are lawyerless courts, right? There's no attorney present oftentimes. And lawyerless courts is a concept identified by legal scholar Anna Carpenter and her colleagues. And they point out that in civil court, people don't have a right to counsel like they do in the criminal justice system and are fighting against things like eviction from their homes, custody of their children, child support, and debt collection. Many of these civil cases disproportionately affect economically marginalized women of color. And when divorce or custody battles in family court involve domestic violence, women are particularly susceptible to unequal power dynamics in the courtroom. So I think we also have a massive opportunity there too.
That was Emily Salisbury, associate professor of social work at the University of Utah and director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center, speaking on a webinar held by the Council on Criminal Justice entitled Domestic Violence: Understanding the Data and Policy. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just a soul. So long. Who's intent?